pastor men, and leading a Bible study series this week entitled Wisdom Literature, The Voice of Human Experience in the Bible. Today we're going to look at Job and the limits of common sense. The first 2 days we looked at wisdom literature, we looked at the book of Proverbs. And the first day we looked at those short sayings that seem to be sort of priceless gems, sort of summaries of a lot of human experience in one-liners. And we noticed the humor that was included in those and the good common sense, kind of the idea that, you know, if you work hard and so forth, that you'll do well, but also concern for the weaker members of society. So these proverbs coming out of the people's experience tell a way of living in the world in community that brings life. And then yesterday we looked at the first 9 chapters, which is an introduction to the whole book, and we saw some of the philosophy of education. We saw that it's a father, set in the context of a father, teaching a son the right paths, and that the two paths were personified by, first of all, a woman, wisdom, and then folly, another woman. And we looked closer at wisdom calling to people, calling for them to follow her ways, offering them life, abundant years, success, and so forth if they follow her ways. And then we also looked at that chapter in 8, which described the relationship between wisdom and God and wisdom and human beings. Rather interesting. Wisdom is kind of a mediator between God and human beings, being present at creation and God creating everything in wisdom. So creation itself has kind of this structure, and if you can just follow the right paths, then you'll do well. So the whole book of Proverbs has a certain optimism. You can learn about the things that you need to learn to have a good life. You can take responsibility for your life and so forth, and it provides you kind of some advice about how to lead a good life, a moral life. Well, today we're going to look at the book of Job, and I like to look at this wisdom literature as a kind of dialogue within the Bible. First of all, Proverbs sets up this whole statement that, you know, we can learn the right way of living, take responsibility for lives, and lead good lives. Job says, well, maybe not always. And so you have within the Bible this kind of dialogue which allows the people, us, who are reading the Bible, the possibility of entering into this dialogue and thinking about our lives and suffering and so forth in more rich and diverse ways, I think. Anyway, the one aspect of Proverbs that Job really picks up on is this whole notion that if you lead a good life, if you, you know, follow the wisdom of the ancients and do everything that conventional guidance tells you to do, that you'll have success, long life, and inherit the land, so forth. So when we look at Job, we're introduced, first of all, to a man who follows conventional wisdom and can be seen as kind of a sage. The book of Job begins with a story, and it ends with the ending of that story. So there's a kind of an envelope structure. The first 2 chapters are a story, and the last chapter, the last part of the last chapter, is also part of that same story. Now, in between, you have long poetic section that consists of dialogues between Job and his friends, and ultimately God. Now, this material is some of the most difficult that we have in the Bible. As far as translation, it's very difficult wording in this poetry. In fact, there are a lot of words that only appear there, only appear in this section, in the poetic section of Job, and nowhere else in the Bible. And since a lot of the meaning that we get out of the Hebrew words are derived from other contexts in other books, it's very difficult to translate Job. And so if you do read Job, it's difficult reading even in translation because people don't always know how to translate it. But I think we certainly won't have time to read the whole thing today. This is kind of the Evelyn Wood speed reading course of the Bible, just to show another voice within wisdom literature. But if you do have the patience of Job and read through it someday, I think you'll be rewarded because it's some really beautiful poetry as well. But the opening part is very simple. Very simple. And let's read that just to get us in the frame of mind here. If someone would start and read chapter 1, verse 1, down to 12, and then we'll switch off.
There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. There were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He had 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 she-asses, and very many servants. So that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. His sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each on his day, and they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And when the days of the feast had run their course, Job would send and sanctify them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus Job did continually. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, whence have you come? Satan answered the Lord, from going to and fro on the earth, and from walking up and down on it. And the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil? Then Satan answered the Lord, does Job fear God for thought? Hast thou not put a hedge about him and his house and all that he has on every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But put forth thy hand now, and touch all that he has, and he will curse thee to thy fate. Sorry, this light's terrible. And the Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your power, and upon himself do not put forth your hand. So Satan went forth in the presence of the Lord.
Okay, thanks. So notice the phrases and words, adjectives that are used to describe Job that connect him with the wise man in Proverbs. Can you mention some of those just briefly?
Well, he was blameless and upright. Feared God.
Feared God, and remember...
Shunned evil,
turned away from evil, right. So the beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. You know, that's in Proverbs. Blameless and upright. And then also when God talks about him too, he says, there's none like him on earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil. Well, that's kind of a stock phrase there, isn't it? Anyway, he's also very successful, you know, so that's part of that whole tradition in Proverbs. He's done well. And he's so careful that he even offers sacrifices just in case. He's not sure anything went wrong, but just in case. So he goes that extra step there. But now there's a divine wager. And we have the Lord appearing in the divine council. This is an old image here. So all the divine beings come together. And interestingly enough, Satan, or Satan is how you pronounce it in Hebrew, Satan appears also in the divine council. So just one of the group here that's getting together. We usually think of Satan or the devil as being like way over here, you know, the power of darkness and God's over here and never having any contact. But here, Satan's seen as one of the divine beings that's under God's command. And notice that he never does anything that God doesn't allow him to do. So actually the word satan means adversary in Hebrew. So we have an adversary or prosecuting attorney here. And notice he's pointing out to God. I don't know if this guy is all that righteous, really. He's gotten a lot of reward for his righteousness, you know. So if you take that away, I don't think that he'd continue to be so righteous. So they decide to take on this wager here. So now there's a series of disasters here in 13 to 22. Would somebody read that?
Well, I'll read it from the Jewish Bible.
Okay. And the translation, the Jewish Publication Society translation? Mm-hmm.
One day, as his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in the house of their eldest brother, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the she asses were grazing alongside them." Oh, sorry, I got two pages.
New book.
Yeah. Well, it's all been, Job's been read before I got it. When Sabaeans attacked them and carried them off and put the boys to the sword, I alone had escaped to tell you. This one was still speaking when another came and said, "God's fire fell from heaven, took hold of the sheep and the boys and burned them up. I alone have escaped to tell you." This one was still speaking when another came and said, "A Chaldean formation of three columns made a raid on the camels and carried them off and put the boys to the sword. I alone have escaped to tell you." This one was still speaking when another came and said, "Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in the house of their eldest brother, when suddenly a mighty wind came from the wilderness. It struck down the four corners of the house so that it collapsed upon the young people and they died. I alone have escaped to tell you." Then Job arose, tore his robe, cut off his hair, and threw himself on the ground and worshipped. He said, "Naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord has given, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." For all that, Job did not sin, nor did he cast reproach on God.
Okay, so one after another. They're still talking, and there's another report of disaster, disaster upon disaster. So everything that he has is taken away. But we have Job the patient here, and these famous lines, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." All right, so far he's passed the test. Now, test number two here is set up. If somebody could read the second chapter here, 2:1-10.
"Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, 'Whence have you come?' Satan answered the Lord, 'From going to and fro on the earth, from walking up and down on it.' And the Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil? He still holds fast his integrity, although you move me against him to destroy him without cause.' Then Satan answered the Lord, 'Skin for skin, all that a man has he will give for his life. But put forth thy hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse thee to thy face.' And the Lord said to Satan, 'Behold, he is in your power, only spare his life.' So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord and afflicted Job with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a potsherd with which to scrape himself and sat among the ash. Then his wife said to him, 'Do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die.' But he said to her, You speak as one of the women would speak. Shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive evil? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips.
Mm-hmm. So once again, is the patient Job. You know, it's interesting, when we were looking at Proverbs, some of you probably remember all the emphasis on the tongue, you know, keeping silent, not speaking, you know, until the appropriate moment and so forth in Proverbs. And so here Job's also seen as a wise person, that, you know, his words are very well considered and appropriate. But now, as we continue, we'll see a very different kind of Job. And this is why people have considered this opening to be a story, perhaps a traditional story that's told of a man who loses everything. And then if we were to skip all the parts in the middle here and go to the end, he's passed the test and he's restored. So, you know, God's won the wager and Job's fortunes are restored and he gets 7 more sons and 3 more daughters, as if they were kind of disposable children. But so many consider this to be a traditional story, and the middle part to be a development out of that story, another person's description of suffering and the reaction of the innocent sufferer and the counsel of his friends and so forth, and finally God's presence. And we'll look at that here, because we don't see Job the patient anymore. We see someone who's very angry. But before his words begin, we have the approach of the three friends here in 11 forward. It says, "Now when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that had come upon him, they came each from his own place. Eliphaz, the Temanite, Bildad, the Shuhite, and Zophar, the Naamite. They made an appointment together to come to condole him and comfort him. And when they saw him from afar, they did not recognize him, and they raised their voices and wept. And they rent their robes and sprinkled dust from their heads toward heaven. And they sat with him on the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his suffering was very great." You know, do you know who the shortest man in the Bible is? I can't help it. It's a sad story, but it's actually Bildad, the Shuhite. See, this is my problem. I read this stuff and the stupid stuff comes to my mind. Anyway, so his friends have all come and they can't believe what's happened. So all this, you have Job the patient. But now this is the interesting part. Job's opening his mouth. And he doesn't curse God, notice, but he curses the day of his birth. And God's always involved in child, the development of the child in the womb and the bringing forth to birth and so forth in the Hebrew Bible. So he's getting really close here. He's really angry and he wishes that he had never been born. And I'll just read a few of the verses here. "Let the day perish wherein I was born, and the night which said a man-child is conceived. Let that day be darkness. May God not seek it, nor light shine upon it." So he wishes it had never happened. If you skip over to 11, it says, "Why did I not die at birth, come forth from the womb and expire?" And he says in 13 forward, "For then I should have lain down and been quiet. I would have slept. Then I should have rested with kings and counselors of the earth who rebuilt ruins for themselves, or princes with gold who filled their houses with silver. Why was I not as a hidden, untimely birth, as infants that never see the light?" So he just wishes that he had never been born. Later, he wishes for his death. But remember, he can't die. The poor guy's hanging on with a thread of life. And God has said to Satan, yeah, you can do everything you want with him, but, you know, he can't die. So later, he asks that he could die here. Very bitter. Now, it's interesting here. He complains. And as soon as he starts complaining, he's left that mold of the wise, silent sage. And he's given voice to his deep suffering. And then his friends, they begin to answer him with the words that are very similar to the words we've been studying in Proverbs, that kind of practical common sense, you know, that says, well, no, God would never do this kind of thing to somebody who is righteous. You know, God is just. If you look at
if somebody would read 4, Eliphaz speaks first. And there's a whole series of dialogues. There's 3 different dialogues where Job speaks, then Eliphaz speaks, then Job speaks, then Bildad speaks, then Job speaks, then Zophar speaks. And then that happens 3 times. So he responds, and Job gets more and more worked up and upset as the dialogue continues. But we can get an indication of the kind of advice and words that the so-called comforters are giving to Job. And if we read the words of Eliphaz here, if someone would read 4:2 down to 4:9, I think would be good. 4:2 to 4:9.
If one ventures a word with you, will you be offended? Yet who can keep from speaking? Behold, you have instructed many, and you have strengthened the weak hands. Your words have helped him who is stumbling, and you have made firm the feeble knees. And now it has come to you, and you are impatient. It touches you, and you are dismayed. Is not your fear of God your confidence, and the integrity of your ways your hope? Think now. Who that was innocent ever perished? Or where were the upright cut off? As I have seen those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the shame, saying, by the breath of God they perish, and by the blast of his anger they are consumed.
Mm-hmm. There's a nice little proverb in there, right? Those who... Could you read that one?
Those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same.
Mm-hmm. There's a nice proverb for you. So he's giving this kind of common sense wisdom here as comfort. But Job becomes more and more agitated here with this advice. And it just doesn't seem right at all. He doesn't recall having made any great sins, you know. He just doesn't see why this would happen to him. And so we can look at another example of his speech, his response in Job 7:11, where he's speaking out here. And this is all worth reading. So it's somewhat difficult reading, a lot of it, but you know, if you do have time sometime, you might want to read more of it. So he says, therefore, I will not restrain my voice. I will speak in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. Am I the sea or a sea monster that thou settest a guard over me? He's asking God, you know, am I really that important? Am I something terrible? Am I something powerful that you're fighting with me like this? You know, I'm just a person. He says, you scare me with dreams and terrify me with visions, so that I would choose strangling and death rather than my bones. I loathe my life. I would not live forever. Let me alone, for my days are a breath. What is man that thou dost make so much of him, and that thou dost set thy mind upon him, dost visit him every morning and test him every moment? How long wilt thou not look away from me, nor let me alone to swallow my spittle? If I sin, what do I do to thee, thou watcher of men? Why hast thou made me thy mark? Why have I become a burden to thee? Why dost thou not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? For now I shall lie in the earth. Thou wilt seek me, but I shall not be. So he's saying, well, you know, maybe I did something wrong. I don't know. But it can't have been that big to deserve all this. You know, so his friends are saying, well, it's something you did. And he said, well, maybe I did something wrong. But it certainly, I mean, I don't remember it. And I mean, this is really all out of proportion. So we'll read one more of the comforters' remarks, and then we'll leave them and move on. But if you want to read 8:2 through 8:1 through 7 here, where he's being responded to with more of the wisdom tradition of Proverbs here. 1 through 7. Anybody want to?
I have a different translation.
That's fine. The Good News Bible? Mm-hmm, that's fine.
All right. Mm-hmm. Actually, this is Bildad speaking. Are you finally through with your windy speech? God never twists justice. He never fails to do what is right. Your children must have sinned against God, and so he punished them as they deserved. But turn now and plead with Almighty God. If you are so honest and pure, then God will come and help you and restore your household as your reward. All the wealth you lost will be nothing compared to what God will give you then.
Mm-hmm. So once again, you know, it must have been something that you or your children did, because God is just. So the comforters are maintaining the justice of God, you know, that God will always reward the righteous and so forth. And Job, his experience is he doesn't know what he's done. He doesn't understand this. This doesn't seem right. So more and more, as they keep trying to convince him, well, you know, it must have been something you did. More and more, he says, no, I didn't do anything. He gets angrier and angrier. And finally, he lashes out at them at 19. And he says, you know, how long will you torment me and break me into pieces with words? These 10 times you've cast reproach upon me. Aren't you ashamed to wrong me? And even if it be true that I've erred, my error remains with myself. If indeed you magnify yourself against me and make my humiliation an argument against me, know then that God has put me in the wrong and closed his net around me. Behold, I cry out violence, but I'm not answered. I call aloud, but there's no justice. So he says, you know, you guys are no help, and I've been wronged. God is wrong here. So this is not Job the patient. This is not your traditional Job the patient here. He's really getting angry. He gets so worked up through the course of all of his friends, and they continue time and time again telling him, Job, you know, we can't tolerate this. You know, you're a crazy man. We can't stand this because we know that our God is a just God. So finally, in 30, and especially in 31, Job goes through a whole list of things that he hasn't done. He's making a vow that he's been righteous. For example, if you look in 31:5, for example, he says, if I've walked with falsehood and my foot has hastened to deceit, let me be weighed in a just balance and let God know my integrity. If my step has turned aside from the way and my heart has gone after my eyes, and if any spot has cleaved to my hands, then let me sow and another eat, and let what grows for me be rooted out. Okay, so if I've done any of this, well, then the punishment's just. And other things he says here that he hasn't done in 31:13. If I've rejected the cause of my manservant or my maidservant when they brought up complaint against me, what then shall I do when God rises up? In 16 it says, if I've withheld anything that the poor desired, or have caused the eyes of the widow to fail, or have eaten my morsel alone, and the fatherless has not eaten of it, for from his youth I reared him as a father, and from his mother's womb I guided him. If I've seen anyone perish for lack of clothing, or a poor man without covering, and on, he's listing all these things, you know, I've done all this. You know, what have I done wrong, God? And finally, his only desire then is to see God face to face so that he can confront God and say, you know, where's justice? Where is justice? He says here in 35, oh, that I had one to hear me. It's in 31:35, sorry. He says, oh, that I had one to hear me. And there's also, we didn't look at, there's other passages where he also calls to for a face-to-face meeting with God. That's his primary desire here. And then it says, the words of Job are ended. Now, it's interesting that both Job and his friends, they both take the view that Proverbs puts forward, that good actions will result in reward, and bad actions will result in failure and in misery and so forth. And the friends are saying, well, Job, since you're having such a hard time, you must have done something wrong. And Job is saying, no, I didn't do anything wrong, and God is not just because I'm suffering. So they're both assuming that the principle set forth in Proverbs, you know, that if you do good, that you'll be rewarded, ought to be working always. But we know already from our initial wager that that's not what's happening. There's something else going on here. And so in 32 forward, another friend begins to speak, Elihu, and he says, I'm not satisfied with either of your positions. And he begins to speak of God's power and of God's role in creation and so forth as it goes on. And then so when God finally appears here, and this does appear to be the answer to Job's desire to meet God face to face. So he does have that presence of God at the end. He also, God answers out of the whirlwind and speaks of himself as a creator God. If you were here last time, we looked at the image of God in Proverbs, which was a creator God. And also in this book, Job, God's also a creator God. That image of the creator is used here to stress God's power and sort of his awesomeness. And so, let's see. We can read just a few lines of this just to get the flavor of it. The majesty and glory of God, and also his concern for all the animals, wild animals and so forth, all concern for all creation is stressed in this. But somebody would just read the opening parts here just to get a flavor of it, from 38:1 to 38:11. This is when God appears to Job in answer to his desire to meet God face to face, to challenge him. 38:1-11.
Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind. Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up your loins like a man. I will question you, and you shall declare to me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? And what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Or who shut in the sea with doors when it burst forth from the womb? When I made clouds its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band, and prescribed bounds for it and set bars and doors, and said, thus far shall you come and no farther, and here shall your proud ways be.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. And if you would you like to read 39:1-4, just to give an example of the image of God's care for all creation also?
Do you know when the mountain goats spring forth? Do you observe the calving of the hinds? Can you number the months that they fulfill? And do you know the time when they bring forth? When they crouch, bring forth their offspring, and are delivered of their young? Their young ones become strong. They grow up in the open. They go forth and do not return to them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, this poetry is really beautiful, if you have time to read it. In 40, apparently, Job has no answer to make to the words which he hears. And so it says, and the Lord said to Job, shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty? He who argues with God, let him answer it. And then Job answers the Lord, behold, I'm a small account. What shall I answer thee? I lay my hand on my mouth. I have spoken once, and I will not answer. Twice, but I proceed no further. So he has no words here. And then God says, well, gird up your loins like a man. I'll question you, and you declare to me. Will you even put me in the wrong? Will you condemn me that you may be justified? Okay, so once again, imagery of creation here to show God's power and so forth. And finally then in 42, Job's final response is, I know that thou can do all things and that no purpose of thine can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I've uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me which I did not know. Hear and I will speak. I will question you and you declare unto me. I had heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees thee. Therefore, I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. Well, this is the way that poetry ends. I had a professor at seminary, Walter Mickle, and he had a different translation of this last verse, therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. And his translation was, therefore I am comforted, and now I can't remember what he did with repent, but there was more the sense that Job now had comprehended some of the majesty and mystery and so forth of the universe, and that he, in knowing his own place in the whole scheme of things, found that to be comforting. And also because God had appeared to him, and so he had the presence of God in his time of suffering.
So this is the way the poetry ends, but apparently that wasn't a happy enough ending for some, you know. And so then the story part begins, and in the story part then God says to Eliphaz and the friends, you know, you guys were in the wrong here in this whole thing. You argued wrongly, and so you have to get Job to offer these sacrifices and pray for you. Because he's the one that I think is really, you know, okay. And you guys were blaming him wrongly. So Job offers sacrifices, and then they all go their own way. And then the Lord restores all of Job's fortunes, and he gets twice the amount of the sheep and camels and oxen and she-asses, and he gets the 7 sons and 3 daughters, and it talks about the beauty of his daughters and so forth. And he died an old man full of days. So that's the story version here. Now, at this point, we'd like you to, we'll go into the small groups again for about 10 minutes. And you might want to first express your initial reaction to the story and anything that really strikes you about the story. But then I have a couple of questions, too, that might help your conversation. And the first one is, which character or characters do you identify with in the story as you're reading it? Do I identify with Job? Do I identify with the comforters? With God? Whatever. What difference does it make for your understanding of the story? What's the story about, depending on who you identify with? And then, can you think of examples of people who are unjustly blamed for their suffering today? Maybe who are kind of like the modern Jobs, who are being blamed for their suffering. So if we just take a few minutes, and then we'll get back together and discuss the findings of your group. So you can just, I think 4 is a good number, actually, because there's enough people, and it's small enough. And I don't know. Do you want to be schizophrenic?
Yeah, I'll talk to you like 4.
Okay. We better get back together because we only have about 10 minutes left. Does any group want to share their overall reflections before we, or reactions before we move into these questions? Do you have anything you want to say?
I just thought one thing that in the beginning of Elihu's speech here, it related to our talk on wisdom.
Oh, huh.
And it kind of, it's not tickling when I read it. He says, I'm young and you are old, so I was afraid to tell you what I think.
Huh.
I told myself that you ought to speak, that you older men would share your wisdom. But it is the Spirit of Almighty God that comes to men and gives them wisdom. It is not growing old that makes men wise.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Yeah, he's an upstart, huh? Yeah.
Especially since you talked about wisdom in particular.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is very interesting, because in Proverbs it was always the older people that were instructing the young, and now it seems that the old and wise have kind of, neither of the two sides, Job or the comforters, have been able to come up with anything that's satisfactory, and so this young man steps in, mm-hmm. and he says that it's not age, but it's that God gives wisdom. Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. Well, why don't we can discuss these two questions, and then if other issues come up, then we can address those too. But what character or characters do you identify most when you are listening to the story, or when you read the story yourself, and what difference does it make? Why don't we start with this group and go around?
Well, personally, I would like to identify with Elihu, Oh. Even though I would have to say I'm on the opposite end of the age group.
Oh.
But I have not, for some time, I haven't thought there was a great deal of sanctity in age anyway. So, mm-hmm. But so I would say that that would be the character that I would like to consider myself that I could relate to the best. And the problems that we ran examples of people who were unjustly blamed. We spoke of many of the homeless that we have,
mm-hmm.
and sure there are some of those who are in that situation because of their own mishandling of the situation, but there are also others who are struggling extremely hard to get away from the homeless situation and get a better position in life. And but because part of the homeless are, we could say, are there because of their own shortcomings, we tend to include the whole group there. All they want to do is just sit on relief, comment.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so some could use a good dose of Proverbs, but the homeless are an example, at least some of the homeless are an example of people who are being blamed for their own problems when they're beyond
yes.
them. Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Let's go to this next group. What character or characters did you identify with and what difference did it make?
Well, I guess we don't have a spokesman. I think that we pretty much concluded that we would certainly like to identify with Job.
With Job, uh-huh.
But we probably, in all honesty, would identify more with the counselors, all four of them.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think we, as we look at society today, and speaking of the homeless, all of us have a tendency to say, well, why don't they get out and work?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't they pick themselves up and help themselves?
Mm-hmm.
It's their fault.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is the tendency of human nature.
Mm-hmm.
I think understanding this makes it makes the story of Job more understanding for us, for this erudite group.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so sometimes we're like the comforters who tend to put more of a burden on the person who's already suffering. Yeah, good point. Yeah.
Well, what troubled me was that I was trying to figure out what kind of a testimony this is, the Book of Job. It doesn't seem to be historical,
mm-hmm.
which is the first thing I would think of.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that you could call it allegory. Exactly. But maybe it's maybe this is the antitype of this weird type. Have I got that right?
Well, no, well, tell me a little bit more about what you mean by that, the antitype of which we're the type.
Well, I'm thinking about the old Puritans' use of type and antitype, the Old Testament idea that, that in the Old Testament there's a foreshadowing of things that will come true in our own age. And it strikes me that in all of our discussion here, we finally decided that we agreed with not with Job, but with some of the other characters were testifying and counseling us. And then we talked about the people who have been put upon in our own day, unjustly blamed for suffering, and we easily agreed that there were plenty of examples of this sort of thing, the street people,
mm-hmm.
And so on, and people suffering from war, and the rest of it. And it just strikes me that this whole story is that typical sort of story that where the you seek in the Old Testament the roots of what's going on in your own day. You're looking for the explanations
mm-hmm.
from your own day out of the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
Does this have any relationship to what goes on in the divinity school?
In the Book of Job?
The discussion of this sort of thing.
Well,
I think Job is seen, the story of Job seems like to be a fable, and then the dialogues, you know, they flesh out some of the philosophy or some of the deeper themes that, you know, appear in the story of this innocent sufferer. I mean, obviously innocent sufferer, and do raise a voice of challenge against the optimism of Proverbs. And it's kind of a cautionary break, I think, you know, for kind of the claim that God's always just and everything that we see here on this earth is one of God's decrees, you know. So the people that are doing well, definitely they're blessed, and the people that are not doing so well, you know, they're not on God's side. I think it's a critique of that kind of tendency that people have, you know, to see the successful as being God's friends and the poor necessarily as, you know, being cursed by God or whatever, because definitely Job was a very righteous man. So I think it's a voice within the Bible which speaks and answers Proverbs and says, yes, lots of times people have a responsibility for their lives and can choose to lead a good life and, you know, be successful and so forth, but not always, Job says, but not always. So I really like that dialogue and within the Bible. What about this group? What character or characters did you identify with most, and how did you see the story or the meaning of the story?
I think we mentioned all of them really, you know, off and on, because uh-huh. We see each of those. I was thinking that in some ways I kind of see Satan as being a person that we could identify with, kind of casting some sort of judgment on somebody. Putting ourselves above our station, saying this person is receiving something that really maybe they shouldn't be receiving.
That's a new one. I've never. Yeah, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Can I piggyback on that?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I was facetiously saying this the other day. I like to identify with God, you know.
Oh, right.
And all of a sudden I realized for myself that there's something satanic about especially a good person.
Mm.
You know, everybody, you know, likes a success story, but it's hard to like a successful person. Like the very brothers of Jesus, when they heard that there was a plot down in Jerusalem to get him, they said, why don't you go down to Jerusalem? And you wonder why people could ever turn against Jesus, but if you lived in the same house with Jesus, where Mary was always saying, why don't you make your bed like Jesus does? Why don't you help the physician? Why don't you pick up your sheep? You know, that must have been pretty hard to like Jesus. And I see something satanic in a sort of resentfulness of people who are just so good, you know. It's easy to get that. It's evil and it's, you know, but it's sort of a focus on ourselves when we behave like that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Did your group think of any examples of people who may be, you know, considered as modern day Jobs? You discussed the whole question of innocent suffering.
Well, we mentioned children of broken homes and that sort of thing, mm-hmm. living without both parents,
mm-hmm.
that are not receiving maybe all they could receive in life.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And they seem oftentimes feel like they're at fault.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My wife had a suggestion that I'd like to share.
Okay.
Dan Quayle.
Anyone who can't spell potato, I don't know.
The gay people are being blamed for. The gay people are being blamed
for AIDS. Right, for AIDS. Uh-huh. Actually, this is a very interesting book, Gustavo Gutierrez's book on Job, because he looks at the suffering of the poor in Central and South America and compares them with Job, that they're suffering, but that their suffering is not a result of you know, their own sin.
Many of these days, mm-hmm. the people in Somalia.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wherever there's war,
suffering
the innocent during war, there's just so many.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we're going to have a forum on that on Thursday, too. So, on disasters, what is it called? Disasters within and without what evokes your compassion? Because, you know, we do respond to disasters, and how to decide to what, you know, which disasters to respond to and which ones we don't. So on Thursday night at 9. Yeah, it really is. Yeah, it really is. Okay.
The term bastard, which is no longer acceptable, but now we say illegitimate children. Uh-huh. Dick Gregory used to say there is no such thing as an illegitimate child. Uh-huh. Only illegitimate parents.
Right. Yeah. That's really true. What about this group? How did your reflections lead you in this story? We had one voice identification with God.
I've never understood the book, and I've studied it before, and I'm still not sure.
It raises more questions than it answers, I'm sure.
Sometimes I think his advisors weren't so bad. Mm. It seems like they were trying, knowing what they knew, that we know so much more about now. It seemed like they were responding according to the problems and all. But,
you have a good point. It's easy to blame them when you have the whole story. You know what happened in the divine council, right? But if you're right there.
Well, I'm not so impressed that God didn't know where Satan was. He has to ask him twice where he's been. You know, and I understand the story.
And Satan
went and made a deal with him. It says in Isaiah 54:15, if anyone stirs up strife, it is not from me. And I guess technically it wasn't from God, but he allowed it to happen.
It's a strange story, and it does raise as many questions as it answers, but for me anyway, that, as I've said before, just to repeat sort of my major principle, it's really good to have both Proverbs and Job together, because at least it raises the question of, you know, are we always supposed to see success as, you know, God's reward for living right, and failure as God's punishment? And Job at least says, no, there's other stuff going on. We may not understand it, but no. And in fact, you know, God's appearance to Job, God's presence with Job when he's suffering, is perhaps the most profound answer. Not all of the heartbreaking stories that we hear have that happy ending, you know, in Job either, but perhaps, you know, God's presence is...
He also said he didn't want twice as many camels.
Well, we are out of time. And yes.
Yeah. Good. In the second question.
Yes. Yes.
I think people that unjustly blamed for things are people of ethnic backgrounds, and I think that a real sad part of that is because God made them the way they are not treated like other people. And I think that's real sad. And I think if we don't like someone because of the color of the person's skin, why do we take it out on the person? We should talk it over with God. Mm-hmm. And just because someone has black skin or tan skin or something, they didn't do that to themselves. God made them that way. Mm-hmm. And to have negative feelings because of the way God made us or them, that's God's business.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you. I really appreciate all your comments. And as I say, the book sometimes raises more questions than it answers, but they're good questions, I think. Good questions to wrestle with for all of us. So, thanks a lot.